Welcome to the show, everyone. My name's Tyler Byrne, and this is Lo-Fi Lit. This is a show where I talk to poets, indie writers, publishers, and all that exists in between and outside of that. Today, I talked to D.A. Powell. He received his MFA degree from the Iowa Writers Workshop in 1986. I'm bringing this from poets.org. He's the author of the trilogy of books, Hot Tales, from Grey Wolf Press in 2004. He's nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award, Bunch, Wesleyan University Press 2000, and T. Wesleyan University Press 1998. His poetry collection, Chronic, was published by Grey Wolf Press in 2009. It received the Kingsley Tufts Award and was nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award. His most recent books are Repast, Tea Lunch, and Cocktails, Grey Wolf Press 2014, and Useless Landscape for a Guide for Boys Poems, Grey Wolf Press 2012. I appreciate this so much. This was such a cool opportunity. There was an article on Vice that I read, Giancarlo and Edmund White. Giancarlo was interviewing Edmund White about a sex life, and it was just so open and revealing. And man, and this was like over a decade ago, and I always thought, like, I would love to do that with, like, established writers who are gay, talk about their sex lives, because there's just something revealing there that I don't see a lot of. It's a subject that I could see people taking it the wrong way. Thank you for DA for coming on. This was an excellent conversation. I appreciate this so much. Thank you to Aiden Ryan and Rochelle Tamirno. If Aiden Ryan had not published DA Powell in his Strays pack at Foundlings Press, I would not probably know DA. This probably would not have happened. It's like this was I kind of got the ball rolling. And there was another series of events where I also got to interview DA for a class. All right. I'm out, guys. Thanks for listening, everyone. This has been Lo-Fi Lit. My name's Tyler Byrne. Is that your office?
This is my office.
Nice.
It's kind of a work in progress. But I've got a lot of books here. That keeps me busy. And then I've got, you know, bells and things.
You use the bell?
Only when I'm teaching witchcraft.
You teach witchcraft?
Not witch. Well, I don't teach people how to witch. I teach, you know, witchcraft in relation to poetry.
Oh, that's badass.
I do. Yeah, I do a couple of courses that are sort of drawing upon spiritual practice for writing. And I can't even remember what they're called because I'm on sabbatical, so I'm like so far from thinking about courses. Magic, mysticism, and something.
Well, that's cool. What poets do you refer to? Have you ever done voodoo?
Have I ever done voodoo?
Yeah.
Well, voodoo is a combination of Western African religions and New World religions. I've studied it. I mean, I've read up on it. And for a period of time, I used to make juju dolls.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Little sacks of gree-gree, and I would stuff them with medical cotton. You know, cotton that was coming out of pill bottles.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Do you still have those?
You know, I made them and I gave them away. So hopefully somebody will have, you know, I made one for Kyoko Mori. I made one for Bridget Mullins. I made one for Jory Graham. I made one for my brother and his wife. I made one for my mom. and a bunch of other people. But who knows, you know, what has become of them. But they're very labor intensive because, you know, you have like a doll body, not like this, but, you know, and then I would go out and find broken jewelry, beads, you know, things. I would walk along the railroad tracks and house keys, and I would sew them all over the bodies of it, because I feel like if a doll is made of lost things, then it will bring back those things that are lost that you might feel are missing in your life.
Isn't that, there's like a French term for that. That's like a, like, it's like the trash of one man is the treasure, like, of another. I mean, it's not that exact same thing, but it's close.
Yeah, I'm sure that idea exists a lot. I was thinking of just the ways in which artists over generations have repurposed things that other people would throw away. I had a great aunt who would save the scales off of fish that she caught, and she would catch bugs and save their wings, and she would press them against the glass, you know, like a piece of glass, and make floral patterns and use the fish scales as kind of an iridescent element. And she made these pictures.
Wow.
It's sort of a lost folk art, and maybe lost for good reason.
Well, that's cool. That sounds labor intensive. Yeah.
Yeah. And it also sounds a lot like hoarding, but, you know, hoarding stuff in order to get rid of it, which doesn't make sense.
So this podcast is supposed to be like a quote unquote dirty. You said you would. Well, I guess I tweeted it, and then I felt like maybe it was disrespectful to you, and I deleted it. And then you DM me and you said you're up to do it.
Oh, yeah. So it's supposed to be about dirty poems or dirty life, or
like I was thinking like sex and relationships.
Oh, sex and relationships.
Are you okay with that?
Sure. If I know anything on the subject, I'm happy to talk about it.
When you were coming up, like in your young teens and 20s, did you have any, like, did you read any periodicals on sex, or was there any information on that for you, or did you just have to learn through experience?
Yeah, there weren't a whole lot of periodicals, and then what was available, at least at first, you know, like I would naturally go to like the public library or the junior college library. And most of everything that was available on the subject of sex was in relationship to heterosexual sex. Gayness appeared in various texts, psychological texts, medical texts, but it was always sort of, you know, like alternative. In fact, the first gay rights group that I joined at the junior college in the town where I grew up had a very closeted name. It was called the Alternative Lifestyle Support Organization, ALSO, also. So you could just say you were going also to a meeting, right? And it was like a very closeted, even when I taught as a grad student at University of Iowa, I taught a queer lit course, but it wasn't called a queer lit course because, you know, people might be stigmatized having that on their transcript. So it was called Gender and Sexualities.
Mm-hmm. When you were like joining this group, were there any people that you met? Did you have a boyfriend?
There were people I met. I didn't have a boyfriend. I had a boyfriend when I first came out, but, you know, that was sort of a a very weird relationship. I mean, I was like 15. He was 23. He was an ex-army tank driver that worked at a liquor store, which was cool because then I could get liquor. And he also was dating like five other guys.
Yeah.
Several of whom were classmates of mine.
Oh, wow.
So it took a while for me, you know, from age 15 to get to the age where, you know, when I'm 23, I'm like, wow, the guy I dated when I was 15 was 23. And 23 is like really too old to be dating a 15-year-old.
Did you feel like he was taking advantage of you?
Probably.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yes and no. I felt like I was taking advantage of him because he had a car, he worked at a liquor store, he had a brother who worked at KFC, so he always had cold fried chicken in his refrigerator and poppers. you know, like, what else do you need?
So back then, were you like cruising? I feel uncomfortable like approaching these subjects with you.
Yeah. Cruising, yes, but I had to learn how to cruise. And before that,
how were you taught?
Well, I met gay people, some of whom were in my peer group and some of whom were from the local junior college. And some of whom were, you know, like involved in the theater scene in the town where I lived. So I first had to figure out like how to recognize gay people, which is obvious if you're gay, mm-hmm. but in the beginning, not so easy because, you know, like you can get it wrong a lot. But surprisingly for a small town, there was a very large network of gay people and it was all private parties. You know, so you would get invited to a private party, you would meet people, and then, you know, folks would talk about like how you recognize who's gay and who's not.
What would they say?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what kinds of things I learned then.
Because it's usually in the eyes when you see someone.
Yeah, in the eyes or listening for what they call the dropping of pearls, you know, because sometimes people would want to clue you in that they were gay, but they didn't want to go straight to the nutsack of it, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, so they would drop a reference to maybe a gay bar that you might recognize the name of, or they would drop the name of a gay movie that you might recognize. And so, you know, like having to learn the literature of my own culture was crucial. Also, there were, you know, once I began to figure out, you know, like where it's more likely for people to be cruising, that was helpful. There was an adult bookstore in my town that had, you know, quarter movies in the back. And some hilarious things occurred in the beginning when I was just like, I don't know who's gay or who's not gay.
Do you have like one incident?
Yeah, let's see. Well, for example, when I first discovered the back room of the bookstore, I was watching one of those quarter movies, which was not very good, you know. I mean, it wasn't a good movie, but also like the way in which it was being shown, it's like you could barely see what was going on, and maybe that was partially intentional. But I had a bottle of poppers that I was very enamored of, and I was probably 16 by this time. And so I'm watching the movie and I'm inhaling the poppers because I know that that's like a way to tell people I'm gay or available. But also what I didn't understand from the other perspective is like, most people aren't going to hit on someone who looks like they're 12. I mean, I was very young looking, even for my very young age. This guy next to me who was watching a movie, I wasn't really paying attention to him because I wasn't attracted or interested, but he taps me on the shoulder and sort of signals that he wants some poppers. So I was like, okay, you know, I give him the bottle of poppers, he hands it back, and then there was a little bit of a delay, maybe 3 seconds later, I hear something heavy hit the floor, and it was this guy, and he had passed out from the poppers, and his erect penis was in his hand.
Oh my God.
And then there was like an older heterosexual couple also in the back room, and they're kind of looking over to see what's going on. And I just kind of like stepped over him and went out. You know, like there was no sense of, oh, I need to help this guy or say something to someone, because I was there under so many, you know, like broken rules.
Mm-hmm. What do poppers do? I've never had one.
Poppers kind of constrict the circulatory system in the head so that all of your blood sort of, you know, as little of it as possible is in your head for a minute or so. And it causes a head rush.
Okay. So were you like, you said taking like a popper was a sign that you were open?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Like when you would go to a party at a gay person's house, when people got out on the dance floor and danced, everyone was popping, but passing poppers around. It was just, you know, like it was part of the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Part of your toolkit.
Did you take the poppers from the guy that had passed out? Did you like get your poppers back?
Well, he had already handed them back.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Otherwise, I probably would have paused for a moment. But also, that place sold poppers, so.
Okay.
Did back you then, they were pretty easy to buy.
Did you consider yourself an activist back then?
I did. Not in high school, but after high school, I went to San Jose State for 2 semesters and to join the Gay and Lesbian Student Association, which I think at that time was called the Gay Student Union, and they were debating over whether they would be called the Gay and Lesbian Student Union. You know, this was a debate that was happening in real time. Mm-hmm. All over the queer community. The Pride Parade at that time was called the Gay Liberation Parade. It wasn't yet the Gay and Lesbian Liberation Parade. And then it became Gay, Lesbian, and Trans. And then they switched it to Pride.
Yeah. So, I remember, like, 10 years ago at like Oklahoma State, they were still like arguing over what their organization name should be. I think that's just like a constant debate about.
Yeah.
So
it's a way to kind of slow down things and make sure that everyone's feeling included and heard. And it's important, but yeah, I just the number of conversations that the queer community was having in those days, even about the word queer, you know, which the embracing of a slur was for older gays, it was like a non-starter. The older gays did not want to be called queer.
Mm-hmm.
But then when gay became a more prominent slur, when people started using gay as a pejorative, then older gays were like, well, fuck it. We're going to go for queer. Because it sounds like we might cut your throat.
Yeah, I saw like a... It was on the Internet Archive. I was looking up like the Mattachine Society. Like they had a pamphlet and it said like, we don't want to be known as queer. And it's so interesting now because that is the catch-all that like everyone uses.
Yeah. And the Mattachine Society were also assimilationists. You know, they were very much about trying not to look like they were dangerous. So, you know, men wearing ties, women wearing skirts. And, it's funny because assimilation has always been something that is being pushed or even generated by the queer community. And it's exactly the reason why I became more of an activist, which was to push back on that idea of assimilation. I'm not fighting for the freedom to be like everyone else. I'm fighting for the freedom to be like myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really important, you know, the Pride Parade, as it became less queer and more pride and more family friendly, began to sort of push all the different body types and the fetishists and anybody that they saw as not projecting a positive image of the community, they all got sort of pushed to the back of the parade. In place of them, we got corporate sponsorships.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with the fight for equality, which I always thought meant job equality and meant protection from states that had laws that demonized or outlawed homosexuality. Suddenly the focus became not those issues that affect everybody, but property rights and marriage equality and the kinds of things that, you know, ordinary Americans can kind of get behind. They're just a couple of gay people who want to be married and raise kids. And isn't that sweet, you know? And like, no, I want the freedom to be kinky and weird and to wear outrageous things and to not have people kill me on account of who I am.
Have you ever had a direct confrontation with someone that was trying to assault you or attack you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
When?
I'll tell you about one experience that I had, which was in maybe the mid-80s. I was living in a small town where most of the queer social life happened at a park. It was also a cruising park, but there was also this social aspect, this social dimension, where people would, on a Friday night, go down to the park with their cars and their a generator and a music box, you know, and we'd have parties down there. One particular night, I was at the park and there were a couple of other cars with people in them. But they were all sort of drugged up, and some of them were queer and some of them weren't. One of the guys who wasn't queer came up and asked me if he could trade me something for I had a Dead Kennedys tape in my tape deck that I had been playing. And said, no, that's all right. So he goes back and talks to his friend in the driver's seat. And then they both come over and they just start assaulting me.
Like hitting you? Like punching you?
Hitting me.
Wow.
So it took me a moment to realize it wasn't a joke, you know, and also to realize that nobody who was witnessing this at this moment was going to help me. So I had to fight back. And I managed to open my car because that's where the tape was that this guy wanted. So once I got in, like I was reaching for the glove box, I just started kicking. I started kicking these two guys that were trying to, that were assaulting me. And I kicked and kicked and kicked until I could slam the door. And then I drove to a nearby restaurant where I knew the owner. And she called the police for me and took me to the emergency room because I was pretty badly beaten up. I mean, these guys had like steel toe boots.
My God.
And they probably would have killed me. I mean, I heard one of them say, get the knife.
Jesus.
I'm kicking for my life. So I got the plate number of the car of the two guys who assaulted me. And the police were able to track down the driver. And then I had to go to court to testify, which was scary because I'm waiting in the hallway and my assailant is sitting on the bench next to me.
Oh my God.
Like, this is just fucking freaky, which just goes to show how little the court system cared about queer assault victims. It turned out that the guy ended up getting probation because, you know, I wasn't allowed to hear his testimony. He was allowed to hear mine because you can hear those who are testifying against you, which I was. But he wasn't testifying against me. He was testifying in his own defense. But his defense was that I had that I had solicited him,
mm-hmm.
and that he felt threatened and fought, and that was a legitimate defense at the time. That, you know, queer panic. It was the defense for Dan White when he was found guilty of lesser charges for murdering Harvey Milk. You know, his defense was, I was under a lot of stress. I had eaten a lot of junk food, and queer people made me very, very anxious.
Mentally, did that have an effect on you? Did that give you like PTSD from like going out?
Oh, hell yeah. And, you know, I mean, they had like witness services, but there was nothing really that was helping me at the time. I was living in my car. I mean, I was just like, you know, trying to stay alive. Something just, you know how the computer is. It's always. I was sort of completely fucked up over that for a long time. And I began to understand that you have to be prepared. There may be situations where people won't fight for you and you have to fight for yourself. I mean, I still, this is sort of a throwback to the 1980s, but, you know, when straight people were coming into the Polk Gulch or the Castro, and bringing pit bulls to sick on gay people.
Oh my God.
They were assaulting people from cars or on foot. There was this movement to get whistles. This is my, it says Castro Community on Patrol. And that was the way that we fought back against gay bashers, was to summon people in numbers.
And you still have it on your
key? I still have it on my key ring. Yeah, I just got into an argument with someone over the summer. This past summer, I was going to a Willie Nelson concert, and you know how they make you empty your pockets and they're checking everything. And the woman says, "What is this? Is it paraphernalia? Are you using this to smoke marijuana?" I'm like, "No, that's not a pipe. It's a whistle." And she's like, "Oh, well, you can't have a whistle." I'm like, "Why not?"
Mm-hmm.
It's disruptive. I'm like, everybody that's going in has a cell phone. Cell phones are more likely to be disruptive. And I'm like, I'm an assault survivor. This is like my protection. You can't just, but they wouldn't let me in with it. So I had to go all the way back to the car and put it in.
Well, that's bullshit.
It's total bullshit. But
that's the entire point. It's supposed to be disruptive because you're disrupting and letting people know. Yeah.
And I'm only going to use it in the event of assault. So,
yeah.
You know, but how are you going to guarantee in this large venue that I'm not going to be assaulted? And that if I am, someone's going to come to my rescue. History has proven that that's not necessarily true.
Were you on edge? Because you had to put your whistle away? I'd be shit.
Yeah, I was. I just did it because it was Willie Nelson's. It was the day before his 90th birthday.
Okay.
See him.
Back in like the 80s, were there any writers that you read that spoke to these things going on? Like maybe like, I don't know, Edmund White or any other writers?
Yeah. I mean, you know, what I was reading at the time was I was reading a lot of newspapers, community newspapers, like Sacramento had one called Mom Guess What, that was a queer newspaper. San Francisco had the BAR and Sentinel, and I subscribed when I, you know, at times that I had an address. I subscribed to a lot of socialist papers, International Spartacus, because those were the kinds of things where you could find solidarity and support. In terms of literary sources, my first genre of reading was plays. And frankly, depictions of gays in plays was often pretty horrible.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, go back and look at Boys in the Band. It's a very sad play, and everyone seems miserable. Also very witty, but miserable. Suddenly last summer, the queer character is killed off, thanks to advice from Tennessee Williams's psychologist, who said, "You need to write a play in which you kill off your queerness."
Oh wait, that's why they killed off the character? Oh my God.
That's why Tennessee Williams wrote it. Yeah.
Fuck.
And then the Children's Hour, where you know, there's suicide. Depictions of gay characters in literature were not great. I mean, the first book that I read that had a positive queer character was The Front Runner by what was her name? Patricia Nell Warren. And even in The Front Runner, right? There's the queer character who gets assassinated. Yeah. What else did I read? I read the Best Little Boy in the World by John Reed, which was actually maybe the first instance of a piece of literature involving queer characters where the queer character did not suffer harm.
Did you ever feel like there was like in the, like the literary spaces, like there was a community of gay or queer or people?
Yeah. When I got into the literary world, because remember, I was starting out wanting to be a playwright. So I was in the theater world, okay. Which had its own quite robust and permissive support universe. But then when I stepped into literary spaces, that was when I started school at Sonoma State in the mid 80s. And there were a lot of queer writers in the community through this organization called the Russian River Writers Guild. And it was a lot of folks who had left San Francisco at the end of the 60s, the beginning of the 70s, during the death of the hippie movement, mm-hmm. and had moved up to the Russian River. There was a guy, Paul Mariah, who ran a press called Man Root Press. It was the first gay-owned, gay-run literary press.
Oh, cool.
In the United States, and he published translations of Cocteau, and published the first celebration of the work of Jack Spicer, you know, almost 9 years after Spicer's death. There was a guy who lived up on the Russian River whose name was Hans Volker. He was a Hart Crane scholar.
Yeah, I'm going to go back when I record this and like go back and listen to it and like pick up these names and like look them up. Because I don't feel like there's enough history, I guess, specific history on these communities or like a perspective. Yeah. I wish there was more of that. And like right now, I don't feel like there's a centralized community. It's more like fragmented across like the internet.
Yeah, right. And you have to keep in mind that, you know, this was all prior to the internet.
Oh, yeah. So
the way that you found people was by reading things on bulletin boards and cafes, picking up alternative newspapers, word of mouth. And of course, you know, any good college would have a women's center. Women's center was also a safe space for queer people.
And you said you were living out of your car at this time?
In it, not out of it.
Oh.
I was living out of it at a different time, but yeah, I was living in it.
Wait, what's the difference between out of it and in it?
Well, out of it, you go out of your car and sleep in another place. In it means you're sleeping in the car for the night.
Did you ever get like kicked out from like someone's like house?
No.
A breakup or something?
No. Usually if there was a breakup, I was the one who was voluntarily leaving.
Okay. And were you staying at like guys' house or were they like your friends' houses?
Some of both. You mm-hmm. know, wherever there was a bed or whatever. But yeah, when I was living in my car, I had been living in an apartment, but I had had a couple of bad monetary decisions. involving things that were not legal.
Like what?
Well, like drugs, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Poppers
or something more extreme?
No, poppers would have not counted as a drug. This was other things.
Was it like cocaine or heroin?
No. I mean, I lived downstairs from some cocaine dealers, but cocaine I never really needed. No, this was something else.
Marijuana?
Not marijuana.
Oh, what is it?
Also, I don't consider a drug.
Okay.
But what
other drugs are there?
Yeah, is it important that you know?
No, I'm nosy as fuck.
Yeah.
You don't want to say? That's fine.
I won't say.
Okay.
But it was something that...
We'll leave it up to the imagination.
Leave it up to the imagination.
It's more poetic.
In any case, people that that deal in such substances aren't always as up and up as they might seem on first meeting. And so I was suddenly unable to pay my rent. And I moved in with a friend in Petaluma for a time so that I could finish out the semester. And then I was just like, well, I'm kind of free to go wherever. And I put things in storage and just took what I felt was the necessities and put them in my little car. And in the summertime in California, it's very easy to live in a car because you don't have to worry about things like heat. But as things got colder and more miserable, I finally ended up moving into a back room of a house that was shared by a costume designer and a floral designer.
Mm-hmm. As the 80s were moving on and the epidemic had started, the HIV and AIDS epidemic, were there the way that men meet, were you more cautious? How was your reaction to everything? And were there more, like, did you, your friends, were they passing, I guess, like away? Did you know people that were passing away?
I did know people that were passing away. And, the way that you behave and rationalize in a pandemic is probably always the same, because I saw a lot of it with COVID as well. You know, people who would be like, well, I'm taking a risk, but not much of a risk. And also, people did not want to disclose their health status because of fear of discrimination, fear of losing jobs, fear of losing friends. So sometimes you didn't know even close friends could have contracted the virus and be sick, but you didn't know until they went into the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the moment of disclosure, right when it's like, okay, we got a couple of weeks to get everything in order for you.
And what was your reaction as it was first emerging, when you were first learning about it?
When I was first learning about it, that was when I was involved with the Alternative Lifestyle Association at the junior college. And I was at a conference in Sacramento for California statewide LGBT groups, and there were information sessions. And there was one information session. It was conducted by a group of healthcare workers. And this would have been like 1982. So it wasn't AIDS yet. It wasn't even quite ARC yet. They hadn't pinpointed the virus that was involved. So this was an information session where they were just talking about the prevalence of Kaposi sarcoma and the high incidence of people dying from pneumocystis and whether those were related. The expert doctor on the panel was a guy named Sandy Pomerantz. The kinds of questions that people were asking, honestly, were full of their own fear and ignorance. I remember there was an owner of one of the gay bars in Sacramento who asked this doctor if there would be any way of identifying people who had this illness so that they could keep them out of the general population.
Wow.
And it's like, so early on I could see that the types of things people thought were going to solve and address this pandemic were exactly the kinds of things that made it more of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
People were in fear of getting tested. People were in fear of disclosing test results. People were in fear of reprisal.
Yeah, I think they still are.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, what was your personal response to it? Were you maybe first prejudiced and then you had a change in mind over time?
No, I wasn't prejudiced.
Okay.
I mean, I was, I don't think I was,
mm-hmm.
Concerned. Yes. Also, you know, I kept living my life.
Do you want to speak to anyone that lost their lives that you were friends with?
Do I want to speak to them?
Like, no, like, do you want to, like, talk about them or say their name and their story?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I had a good friend that I used to go out to the bars with. His name was Kenny Penny, you know, like J.C. Penny. He was from Michigan, and he was a slut and funny and just, you know, like one of these guys who really just did not take shit from anybody. I loved him.
How'd you meet him?
How did I meet him? I met him cruising. We chatted for a little bit and then sort of went our separate ways. And then later I re-met him. He was a roommate of a friend of mine who was a DJ. And I actually ran into him at the Greyhound terminal in Sacramento. He was picking somebody up. I mean, you know, picking somebody up in the way that one does when they're on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, can I get a ride with you guys? And so, you know, we just became sort of fast friends after that, because the ride wasn't to home first. It was like let's go to Club 21 and have a drink. And, yeah. So Guinea was like really my best friend in the gay community for a long time. And he was one of the guys who was instrumental in starting the alternative lifestyle support organization. He was somebody who wasn't afraid of power centers. But he kind of got burned out on California, or so the story was. And he,
what happened?
Well, I don't know what happened.
Oh.
What I know is that he moved back home to Michigan. But what I later pieced together was that he had contracted AIDS, or what had become AIDS. And then I didn't see him again until a couple of years later. He flew to California to see a mutual friend of ours, in part kind of a goodbye tour.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and,
my God.
They came to see me, and it was just, you know, like, he was always like my older brother, and he was so tired, and he had no appetite, and a lot of the fight had gone out of him too.
Shit.
But we had a good visit, and then, you know, 3 or 4 months later, he died. And there were a lot of people in that period, from the mid 80s to the early 90s. It seemed like, you know, so many of the people that I knew well, and also people that I just knew as sort of like the expanded cast of my life.
Did you like grow like a coldness?
I don't know that I grew a coldness, but I became withdrawn in time from the queer community, and that sort of, I mean, I had gay and lesbian friends that I still hung out with, but I just I got tired of going to bars and running into people that were not doing well. And then I went off to graduate school in the early 90s, mid 90s. And then when I lived in Iowa, it was different because I knew everybody for the same amount of time, which is to say, you know, it was a completely different world. I didn't know anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't date or have sexual relations with anyone within graduate school because it was just too small a fish tank.
Mm-hmm. Was anyone attractive enough?
Oh, people were attractive, but you know, I'm a firm believer that you don't take a shit in the swimming pool.
Yeah,
you know,
I believe that too.
You take a shit in the ocean because it's big; it'll float out there. But I lived in Coralville, which was not downtown Iowa City, and I happened to live next to or close by a truck stop, which had its own, you know, sort of DL sex scene going on. And then right behind that was an adult bookstore that had an arcade, and the arcade was just, you know, like people going and having sex. There was a gay bar in town, but the gay bar in town was very vanilla, you know. It was coming from California, where people were a little bit more edgy.
Mm-hmm.
Iowa's gay bar scene, it just kind of was like sweet.
Yeah.
Too sweet for words.
Too wholesome. Were there like people doing it like in the arcade?
Yes.
Like on like a pinball machine, they're like bent over and they're
playing. It wasn't pinball. That kind of arcade. There were no the arcade was booths. And the booths had movie screens.
Okay.
And people would feed money into the machines. And then right next to the machine, there would be a hole in the wall about that big, the size of a person's head, not quite all of it.
It was like a glory hole?
Yeah, it was like a glory hole, but it was a massive glory hole.
Okay. They were sticking their heads through the hole and sucking the other guy's dick?
Yeah. Okay.
And did you do that?
Yes. I went there.
Okay.
I know others who did, too.
Did you have to know the guy before, or did you just go in there and get sucked off?
No, you didn't have to know anyone. That was the beauty of it.
Oh, cool. Nice. Yeah. What's your best experience?
What's...
Did you have, like, a best orgasm there?
Oh, a best orgasm there. Yeah. I was in a booth watching the movie, and this guy, you know, to signal that things could be passed through the hole, someone would, you know, like rub their fingers along the edge of the hole. So this guy was signaling that he wanted me to stick my dick in there. So I did, and he started going down on me. And then his partner, who was also very hot, came into his booth, and they were doubling down. And they were they were from like Western Iowa, like Council Bluffs area, which is, you know, sort of the ultra conservative side of Iowa. Mm-hmm. And this was their thing. They liked to go to adult arcades across the Midwest and find a third for their thruple.
And do you like meet them afterwards and like talk to them?
Yeah, I talk to them afterwards. I mean, okay. I'm an asshole.
Is that an asshole thing to do? Just like leave right after?
Not necessarily. I mean, you know, like it's not uncommon for people to just leave afterwards, because that's the whole beauty of anonymous sex. You know, you don't have to have any kind of complication, any kind of social nicety or anything. People understand it's a utilitarian moment. But these guys were really nice, you know, like
mm-hmm.
when the sex was happening, when it was all, you know, it was nonverbal and very kind of hot and risque. And then when they started talking, it's just like, oh, yeah, this is our summer trip. We're out here having fun.
When did you see those, like, come to a slow crawl of, like, not being around anymore or diminishing?
I don't know, because I left right after graduate school and came back to California, to San Francisco. And in San Francisco, sex was still happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Midwest has sort of quietly cleaned up a lot of that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Because they're afraid.
Yeah, right. And that real estate could best be served with a giant Marriott. Also, you know, like anonymous sexual encounters have moved to an online format. So, yeah.
When you were first like having sex, did you like know about lube? Were there things that you were like learning about, someone like teach you, or were you like going raw and hardcore?
I did not know about lube. I had to learn that from my friends Matt and David, who were like, you know, talking about lube, and I'm like, whoa, what's lube? yeah, there was a lot I had to learn sort of in the moment, but that was one that I at least got some instruction on.
Did guys clean up when you were first starting out, or like over time, did you notice guys like not cleaning themselves?
Sorry, it's pollen season here.
That's okay.
And I have been just sneezing ever since I got back from Philly, because everything's in bloom and they're cutting all the grass. What was the question about? Some people were very fastidious and others not so much. Variety is the spice of life.
Did you ever like over time like have like a set system that you needed guys to like go through to introduce themselves to you? Like you have to clean up, you have to douche before you meet me.
No. I mean, you know.
Did you ever meet any guys that were like that?
That were like,
like you have to go and shower before we can have sex.
Maybe once. Yeah. No, most of the guys that I had sex with, it was just like, oh, you're hot, let's have sex.
Mm-hmm. Who was your favorite?
Who was my favorite? You mean of like the one-timers, or of all the men that I've had sex with?
Because I guess both. You can choose one.
I think my favorite of all time was my partner, Scott. We were together for a couple of years. And
what happened?
You know, people go through stuff a lot. We just, you know, we weren't necessarily right for each other at that time.
How'd you meet him?
I met him at a pub. I met him drinking, which was in those days what he did best. Now he lives in Pennsylvania. He's an artist. But
what drew you to him?
I don't know what drew me to him, really, because he wasn't like, you know, a magnificent specimen of humanity. He was just kind of a geeky, weird guy with glasses. I think it's that he always has made me feel good about me. You know, like, mm-hmm. If people make you feel good about yourself, you want to be around them.
Oh, yeah.
So I always got a lot of positive reinforcement from him. He'd be like, oh, you're so smart. Or, oh, you do this so well. And Yeah, so I guess compliment me and you got me.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of favorites of people that I didn't know as well, or, you know, it was just in the moment. I mean, there are many vying for second place. I would have to say it often has to do with the erotics of how the encounter happened. Like I met this guy one time. I was on a flight from Chicago to the UK. This was in 1985. It was back when you could still smoke on planes. It was a very wide-bodied TWA flight. I was in the window seat on the left-hand side of this row. There was nobody in the other two seats in my section. There was a middle section of about six seats and then two on the other side. So the guy on the far side of the plane, as the plane was taxiing to take off, we were sort of checking each other out. And then after the plane got airborne, he got up and went to the back of the plane, I assume to the restroom. Then when he came back, he came up my row, he leans over and he says, I see you're traveling by yourself too. Let me know if you want company during dinner. And then he goes back to his seat. So I invited him over. And, he was from Kansas. Or maybe he was from Kansas City. But he was on his way to the UK with a group that he was traveling with, but everybody else was sitting in the non-smoking section of the plane.
And so he comes over, what happens?
He comes over, we sat and talked, and, you know, it was a night flight. So the stewardess came by and was passing out blankets. We got blankets. And as we were flying over Iceland, he leaned over to look at Iceland, and he put his hand in a very sweet spot. And we just went under the blankets and made it on the transatlantic flight.
So he's topping you, or are you topping him?
We were taking turns sucking each other off.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we couldn't fuck because there were stewardesses sitting in the row ahead of us.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was their spot when they weren't on the floor.
Is that part of it? Part of the being taboo?
I suppose so. Yeah, I mean, just the fact that, yeah, there's this mundane conversation going on in front of us where it's just like, you know, going to town.
Did you see that happen a lot on planes?
I didn't. Yeah. In fact, I was pretty sure that that was the sort of thing that just never happened on planes. And then there I was.
So, okay. Did you meet Scott in the 90s?
What?
Did you meet Scott, your partner in the 90s?
I met him in the 80s.
80s, okay. Was that your longest relationship?
No, I think maybe tied for longest.
Okay. Do you long to be in a relationship, or do you mind being like more of a loner?
Well, that's a very, very interesting binary.
Yeah.
Relationship or a loner? Yeah, I'm somewhere in the middle of that. I don't feel like I need or want a relationship in the kind of relationships that people have. I don't need someone to be there all the time. But I'm also, I don't think of myself as alone because I have lots of friends that I spend a lot of time with. Yeah, I'm less interested in sexual relationships just because, you know, like you get older, you're like, yeah, I could do that, or I could work on revising some poems, or, you know,
mm-hmm.
It's like sex sadly becomes less interesting as you get older. I mean, it's not less interesting mentally. Mentally, I'm still very much stimulated by sex. I still have a, I think, reasonably healthy relationship with masturbation and other things. But I don't need sex.
Yeah.
And then when I do have it, it's kind of like, okay, there's that. I mean, you know, like, I think the last time it wasn't the last time I had sex, but maybe two times before that, it was the sort of encounter where I was like, yeah, this is fine and all, but I'm not really into this. And I would actually have a better time with this person if we weren't having sex. But he was sort of insistent, and I'm kind of like, yeah, okay, whatever. And it was in an alley, you know, we had just been to dinner.
Was it the last time?
No, this was like three times back.
Oh, okay. And you did it in an alley?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Because we were talking about how back in the old days in San Francisco, you just go into an alley and have sex. And he kind of grabs me playfully and he says, well, we're in an alley right now. I'm like, yeah, we are, but there are people around. And he's like, you don't care.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I guess I don't.
Was there any kinks that were too extreme for you? You know, like, I need to get out of here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, like what?
I don't know. Usually it was group dynamics and involving, you know, torture and things like that.
Really?
Yeah, people who are into just the erotics of pain.
Ooh. Were you ever like in, like it was going on and like I need to get out of here?
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, that's the thing is nobody just walks up to you and says, hey, do you want to come play in a dungeon?
Mm-hmm.
They sort of invite you over for drinks, and then you're having a good time, and it's like, let's do this. And then, you know, it's incremental. And it's like the story of the frog where the water starts boiling and it happens so slowly that the frog doesn't notice. And I'm always the person who's like, I think that this water is about to boil.
Mm-hmm. It's like that Edgar Allan Poe story. Like which catacombs, one? the oh, I forgot what it's called, with Montressor and Fortunato.
Oh, the Cask of Amontillado.
Yeah, where he like leads him down into the catacombs and like builds a catacomb around him, and he doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or like Benito Cereno, where it takes main character a long time to realize that he is on a ship that has undergone mutiny, and that all of the people that he sees are in fact prisoners.
Wow.
And not you know, not supposed to let on. Yeah, I think I have a pretty good sense of self-preservation, just because, you know, there are often times in my life where I feel like I just dodged a bullet there.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever with a guy and you wanted to see again, but that wasn't going to happen? Or did you ever do you believe in love too?
I do believe in love. Nothing wrong with it. Love and sex need not be interconnected. Sometimes it's better if they're not. What was the beginning of that question?
I forget.
Okay.
My head went blank. I don't know. There's a lot of hetero people I see a lot of the time just talking about love, and I'm just like, or they're sad or something, or they're grieving over a miss or relationship, and I'm like, yo, just try being gay in your life, because it's just there's so many less options. I think even right now, I don't see myself probably being in a long-term relationship anytime soon, just because of this state of the world, the way it's in, and living in Tulsa and living in a small town.
Right. You don't want to put down roots someplace where you feel like you may want to escape.
And there's no options, though. There's just no. It's like if you're not successessful, because I just see a lot of successessful writers, something they have boyfriends after they've already found success with their writing, you know. And when you're not successful, you're not going to have the potential to be in a relationship.
Yeah.
Do you think if there were more variety of options for you that you would have found someone? I don't know. I don't know why I'm stuck on this.
Yeah, no, I don't know, because I think that I probably would choose the more difficult path.
Mm-hmm.
Just because that seems to be my history, right? It's it's much easier for me to fall in love with people that are problems than to fall in love with people who are perfectly nice.
You like the bad boys?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that goes back some to that first boyfriend who was, you know, he was really an asshole.
How so?
he was an IV drug user. He was very physically abusive. He had no concern long term about anything or anyone. And I was more okay with that than with the guys who wanted to date and will you be my boyfriend? And it's
mm-hmm.
I think I'd much rather be with the guy who just wants to be with me in the moment, and then maybe later, maybe not.
Who's the highest profile person you've been with?
What do you mean highest profile?
Celebrity, biggest name in the writing world or outside the writing world?
Oh, I don't think I've been with any celebrities.
Okay.
Why? Are there celebrities that say otherwise?
No, I was just wondering.
Yeah, I can't think of. Oh, yeah, I can think of some, but I'm not going to say.
Ooh, gossip. Have you been to ever a writing conference or something and you hooked up with a fan or another writer, I guess?
Did I ever hook up at a writing conference?
Or AWP?
Probably.
Yeah?
But. Doesn't come to mind. I mean, I haven't been to AWP in a long time.
Yeah. Are you critical of AWP?
I'm not critical of AWP. AWP is good for some people. It's just, I don't need that much stimulation.
Oh, yeah.
I've discovered over time that I'm in fact happier not going to AWP because I am not good at walking away from conversations. And as a result, I get sort of, you know, like wherever I'm going at the conference, I'm always stopped by people. And I don't like that serial, you know, it's like, I said this to someone the other day and they laughed. I said, AWP is like speed dating with people that you already know and wouldn't date.
Yeah. Do you take more value out of your friendships?
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, friends are friends, you know, they're long-term commitments, whereas love, not necessarily.
Yeah. Was there ever a time, a friend that you have where there was turmoil for a few years, but then you guys got over it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have a friend in Connecticut. We've known each other. Well, we've known each other since, you know, sometime in the 80s. We were roommates for a while and really did not get along as roommates. And, we had a lot of times where our friendship had to, you know, had to sort of die and be reborn.
Mm-hmm.
But I consider him one of my best friends. Okay. Also someone that I would not date or want to live with.
So it's been about 90 minutes. Do you need to get going?
I should, because I've got to meet with the director of the program here, and then I've got all of these emails that I'm supposed to respond to.
Okay.
Other projects that I've said yes to.
Can I ask one last thing?
Oh, of course.
What's like? Is there like one secret move that you have that can really make a dude just blow his mind out?
Secret move. Yeah, I don't know, because I think one of the beauties of sex is that every person is different. So it's a little bit like, well, let's say you're a pretty good musician, but every time you're picking up a different instrument.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, this vibrates in a particular way that is, I've never encountered this before. And I like that sense of newness. I like that sense of figuring out what valves to push and where to blow.
Yeah, I like that. Well, I guess we'll end there. Thanks for coming on. This has been awesome.
All righty. Thanks for doing this. And this is just, this is a audio thing, right?
Yeah, I might take a screenshot of you to post, like the ad.
That's fine. Then do you go and edit it and clean it up?
Yeah, a little bit. I'll probably take like when the person came to your office, I'll probably edit that part out.
Yeah. Yeah. People never come to my office. That was the weird thing.
This is because you're doing this. They wanted to interrupt you.
Yeah. And mostly my office is very self-contained, except there's like this little window where I can see if someone's out there. And most of the time, they're just like plugging their device into the little plug down there. This was someone who was standing there taking things off of my cork board. And I'm like, what is it? Oh, they're looking for my name, because I always cover up my name.
Are there any books, though, that you would like point to people, queer or otherwise, that you found like you felt related, that you related with?
Yeah. Well, definitely in poetry, there's so much more that you can get away with in poetry because fewer people are reading it. And also, you know, poetry is so, it's full of metaphor and things that people can read whatever way they choose. So, you know, when I started reading poetry, seriously, when I gave up playwriting, there were a few people that just rocked my world as far as what you could get away with saying. And I would say John Wiener's. Do you know his work at all?
No.
Can I, let me see if I have my collected John Wiener's. Oh, and also this guy,
Tom Gunn.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Okay,
do you know his work at all?
No.
Shut up, really?
I don't.
Oh,
I'm very limited with what I know.
Well, then that's a good rabbit hole to fall down.
Okay.
And then John Wiener's, who lived over in the Polk Gulch area, which was like the gay epicenter of San Francisco before it moved to the Castro. And it was more of a hustler scene too, you know, like the intersection of queerness and sex work was much more fluid in the world of the 70s and 80s because, you know, you were an outlaw either way.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever participate in sex work?
That's for another conversation.
Okay, we'll have you back on sometime.
This poem is called 2 Years Later. It's just 4 lines long. 2 years later. The hollow eyes of shock remain. Electric sockets burnt out in the skull. The beauty of men never disappears, but drives a blue car through the stars.
Wow.
And he has a poem for cocksuckers. This was part of his early. Well, we can go in the queer bars with our long hair reaching down to the ground, and we can sing our songs of love like the black mama on the jukebox. After all, what have we got left? On our right, the fairies giggle in their lacquered voices and blow smoke in your eyes. Let them. The gifts do not desert us. Fountains do not dry up. There are rivers running. There are mountains swelling for spring to cascade. It is all here between the powdered legs and painted eyes of the fairy friends who do not fail us in our hour of despair. Take not away from me the small fires I burn in the memory of love.
Shit.
Yeah, check him out. He was a warrior. All right. I should get to work, otherwise I'll never get work done, and then
okay.
Get to play.
See ya. Thank you for coming on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
No problem. And that was D.A. Powell. That was a great conversation. I really enjoyed that.